Ушел из жизни Борис Березовский. За последние 24...
Hello, the exiled Russian businessman and prominent critic of the Kremlin.
Dans l'enquête sur la mort de Boris Berezovsky, Scotland Yard
Boris Berezovsky was once considered one of Russia's richest.
The controversial Russian businessman Boris Berezovsky.
My friends say Berezovsky was found dead in his bath.
Скончался Борис Березовский. Сначала об этом стало известно.
He was called the godfather of the Kremlin and a modern-day Rasputin. At the height of his power, he could bring down governments and is widely believed to have handpicked Vladimir Putin as president. But in the end, Boris Berezovsky died alone, powerless, in exile, and in financial ruin. The Berezovsky story has many lessons, that when the tectonic plates of Russian politics shift, change can be rapid and unforgiving, that the fall from the pinnacle of power can be extremely fast and perilously steep, that today's protege can become tomorrow's mortal adversary. Commentators have called Berezovsky's death in last weekend the end of an era, but I'm not so sure that's the case. The system Berezovsky lorded over in the 1990s, marked by a political labyrinth of clan battles and intrigue, and the primacy of informal networks over formal institutions, is still very much with us. It just has different masters. Berezovsky is dead. Long live Berezovsky. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is my regular co-host, Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russian security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. Glad to see you got back to New York in one piece.
Thanks very much.
Mark, to get the ball rolling, I wanted to play a couple of clips of Berezovsky. One from when he appeared to be at the pinnacle of his power, and another during his exile in Britain. Here he is speaking to CNN in January 2000, shortly after Putin was inaugurated as president. Let's listen.
I think that Putin will continue the way which President Yeltsin established in Russia.
And here he is, 7 years later, speaking to the British daily, The Guardian.
We need to use force to change this regime. Because, first of all, this regime is anti-constitutional. It means that I call to use force to recreate constitutional regime again. It means that I am for constitution and Putin is against the constitution. And understanding that Putin create authoritarian regime, I force, I present that no chance to change that through elections and only way to use power.
Now, that first clip came from a time when Berezovsky and the so-called family, the group of oligarchs and cronies close to Yeltsin, were widely seen as invincible in Russian politics. Putin was even known as the family's candidate. What a difference 7 years makes. We all know what happened. Putin outfoxed Berezovsky, forced him into exile, and either marginalized or co-opted the other members of the fabled family, thus that second clip. Mark, what does this tell us about how quickly and how dramatically power can slip from one's hands in Russia? And are there lessons to be drawn today?
I think there are. It's quite interesting that for a man who was so patently very, very clever, Berezovsky could also be deeply, deeply stupid. In the way that, first of all, he was taken in by sort of Putin's appearance. Putin, the man without a face, rose up, allowing everyone to sort of basically overlay their expectations upon him until he was actually in power. But secondly, I think what Putin showed and what Putin sort of demonstrated so sort of vigorously to Berezovsky, which helps explain how quickly Berezovsky sort of fell from grace, was although this is clearly a very, very personalized system, you know, this is the court of the president. It was under Yeltsin. It is under Putin. Nonetheless, power is institutional. Berezovsky put all his faith in the sort of the substrate of connections and payoff and expectations of favors owed and everything else, without realizing that as soon as he installed Putin behind the big desk in the Kremlin, suddenly all institutional power was there. And therefore he had to rely entirely on his personal relationship with Putin, which he dramatically mismanaged. So for me, there's a lesson about the rapid fall of the rise and fall of Berezovsky. It's that under Yeltsin, actually, power was thoroughly deinstitutionalized. and Berezovsky was in his element as a manipulator, puppeteer, and so forth. But the structures were all still there. And once Putin came back to power, he could reinvigorate the institutions of the state and not just ignore Berezovsky, but destroy him. So I think that, for me, is one of the key lessons.
But yet the informal networks remain important even in Putin's Russia.
But they remain important insofar as they feed into how the formal networks get used. The whole point is that some mate of Putin's puts in a word and then the instructions go out. And when they go out, they have the backing of the institutions of the state behind them. So in other words, it's what happens in that little black box of decision-making at the top. So I'm certainly not saying that this is a regime that operates entirely as the rules say so. I'm just saying what Berezovsky didn't understand is the limitations of those personal contacts. It's all about if you have the Tsar's ear. And that's fine so long as you have the Tsar's ear, but as soon as you've lost it, that's it.
Kirill?
Let's observe Berezovsky from the various points of view. It's very interesting that Berezovsky and I, watched closely what was going on after his death in Russian media and so on. In some sense, he is, a champion of as an object of various comparisons and analogies. Someone called him New Gerzen, a famous Russian, socialist exiled in London. Other called them, as you told, Rasputin, yes, and so on. A lot of them.
He was called Trotsky to Putin's
yes,
Stalin.
The most stupid is Trotsky, of course, comparison. It's very interesting that we are speaking now about Berezovsky as a public image, kind of, sort of public image. And from this point of view, he was a sort of classic Russian literary role model. He looks like one of the, personages of Dostoevsky possessed novel. At the same time, Verkhovensky the Younger and Stavrogin. Right. And his end was like Stavrogin's. Mm-hmm. He hanged himself, maybe. I don't know. Well, no one knows. But anyway. But speaking more seriously, I totally agree with Mark about the limitations of this, informal attitude to politics in Russia. Of course, that was almost total chaos in the middle of the 1990s in Russian politics. But let's, analyze or deconstruct what is the meaning of this chaos? What is the reason of this chaos? It is very interesting that all this struggle between oligarchs and various clans and so on in the 1990s, that was a struggle over the legacy of Soviet economy. It was not about something new. It was just about the old-style economy, which was, is partly in ruins, but still worth to fight over. So he was one of the champions of this, struggle. Of course, with his wit, with his, with his mind, which was very sophisticated in some sense. In some sense, he was very stupid.
He studied game theory and mathematics.
Yes.
He liked to construct systems.
Don't forget, he was член корреспондент. I don't know how it's in English. Член корреспондент Академии наук. He was a member of Academy.
Yes.
And that is on one hand. On the other hand, that was that there were no any, a real politics on this stage. So we have a legacy of old Soviet economy, and we don't have a new politics. We don't have a new politics. But we have all these informal ties and struggle and so on instead of politics. And here in this so-called chaos, which was consisted from two parts of this economic parts and politics parts, he was a champion. But when the situation changed, and even in economical terms, when in the beginning of 2000s Russian economy began something new, then he failed because he couldn't understand, he couldn't get a new agenda. Not just political agenda, but economical agenda, social agenda, and so on. That's why he looked so outdated even in 2000. Mm. Yeah. So that is my second point. And the third point, it's about limitations. Of course, it's not just psychological limitations or political limitations of these informal ties and so on. It's very interesting. It's psychological and social limitations, because he never knew such people like Putin before. Right. In Soviet times. He is from the absolutely different background. And from other degeneration, don't forget about this. And that's why he, you know, made such a mistake.
And we're going to return to this theme continuously throughout this podcast, but we've made comparisons to late Yeltsin to today, right? The looking at late Yeltsin, you cannot help but, of course, look at Berezovsky. And so what I wanted to ask to you, Mark, is if you look at the sources of Berezovsky's power, and you touched on this a little bit, and compare them to the sources of Putin's power and the reasons that Berezovsky's power waned. And can we apply any lessons to today? The inevitable question.
And the inevitable answer is yes and no.
You always say yes and no. That's what I like about you.
It's dialectics, yeah.
I think absolutely Kirill's spot on about the extent to which Berezovsky was, you know, should be seen as rooted in the 1990s and in the situation there. It's not often that I find myself approvingly quoting communist leader Zhuganov. But I mean, he called Berezovsky a typical spawn of the awful 1990s. And I think that's right. Berezovsky was not a builder. He was not a creator. He was a great exploiter of the circumstances. So if we compare sort of him and his power and his environment to what's going on now, yes, we see as then a power struggle, a succession struggle, as well as a struggle over resources, access to them, control of them, and who can tax them and rent, seek off them. But for me, the political environment is entirely different. I mean, in some ways, actually, if I was going to draw a comparison, it would be, for example, between Berezovsky and Sechin, as perhaps, you know, key figures who are political economic dukes or earls or whatever in the kingdom. The big difference is clearly, you know, Sechin is not out there being a public figure. Sechin is not out there sort of seeking to build up an empire of media and so forth. Sechin essentially is rooted in state-backed control of key assets. Berezovsky was rooted into trying to essentially rip assets away from the state into his own personal pocket, and in the process, therefore, became dangerous to the state and to the state elite, which is why Putin turned against him. So, yes, the yes is exactly that we now have a succession crisis, and that therefore we have all kinds of manipulations as clans and interest groups and individuals feud over power in this moment of opportunity and potentially who gets to be or pick the successor. But we actually now have a much, much more strongly rooted political system that is rooted in the institutions of state, whereas in the 1990s, essentially the political system, the power structure, was outside the state. It was in all these various oligarchs and robber barons.
Would you draw a parallel, though, between, to play devil's advocate, between the family and the oligarchs of the 90s and what we have come to call the deep state today?
For me, the difference is, in some ways, the family was always much more of a... Okay, it wasn't an actual family, but it was much more...
Parts of it were, but...
Exactly, but it was about a sort of a personal coterie, a circle, who were just really dependents and hangers-on. If we look at the deep state now, its members are all players. Its members all have their own interest groups. And so none of them are just simply there just for the unlimited credit card line. I think there is similarity, but you might say, whereas the family were largely just simply drones, the deep state is actually made up of players. And I think that's the difference.
Another area where I see, to add to your similarities and differences between then and now, one other area of similarity is that the tectonic plates shifted in the late 90s, and Berezovsky was out of tune with that shift. The zeitgeist changed. He, as you and Kirill both said, he was a man that was out of place in the first decade of the 21st century. So I refuse to say the word nuts. So there is a similarity there. And do you think that similarity has any implications whatsoever today?
Yeah, I do. And I think the thing is that, I mean, obviously on one level, it's always hard to actually spot how the movement of these plates is going to change the landscape until it's happened. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the problem. I mean, you know, in some ways, we now look back almost as if there is an inevitability to the downfall of Berezovsky, because we have the benefit of hindsight. There are various different trajectories that actually Russia could have taken. And if, for example, Putin really had been what he seemed to be, in other words, a sort of a pliant apparatchik, who was willing to be manipulated and so forth, we might actually be looking back at the brilliance of Berezovsky, you know, who is currently sort of living in some large castle somewhere or whatever, you know, in Rublyovka or whatever. So, you know, we need to be aware of that. But for me, I mean, the key tectonic plates that we do see shifting is, first of all, the rise of this new middle class. And with it, a slightly different kind of politics, a politics that is rooted in issues to do with accountability and transparency and so forth. That still, at the moment, has relatively little traction, but I think its time is coming. So there's point number one. And the second thing is that we do see much more, I think, clearly the struggle between, you know, whether we call them the managers and the shareholders or whatever, but, you know, people who are rooted in the state's control of the old economy, which is the hydrocarbon economy, and people who actually see that Russia needs to be managed more efficiently. It can't just simply sort of rely on oil and gas exports. They're looking for economic diversification. They're looking for increasing the service sector, possibly turning around economic industrial collapse. All these various things. So, I mean, I think we're definitely seeing pushes for new kinds of politics. What we don't really know is quite what these different pressures are going to create.
No, and you're right about this inevitability question. I mean, I remember being a correspondent during the transition from Yeltsin to Putin, and the assumption among everybody in Moscow is that Berezovsky was invincible, that the family was invincible. I remember writing a lead for a story in that time where I wrote, Putin just inherited Yeltsin's office. Will he also inherit his family? And the majority of the analysts that I spoke to for that, and these are very smart people in Moscow who were following, were saying what I believed at the time as well, that there's no way he's going to be able to escape the tentacles of these people. We underestimated the craftiness of Putin and the power of the formal institutions at the time. Kirill, anything you would like to add on this, the comparing the sources of Berezovsky and Putin's power?
I think that the situation now, it's a little bit, you know, similar to that of 1990s, but in some sense. Let's return to 1990s. We had old-style economy, or remains of old-style economy, and a group of people is trying desperately, to appropriate these things. And we had a new social structure, a little chaotic, mm-hmm. But definitely new in comparison with Soviet times. And we had, just a roots of a new politics, just a roots, very humble roots. But especially in the second part of 1990s, there were such roots in Russian politics, especially in Russian regions. What do we have now? We have totally new economy of Russia, but it's in some sense it's new. Mm-hmm. We have a new social landscape, and we have now with Putin 3.0, we have old-style politics. And that is very interesting, that situation in some sense is similar to this of 1990s. And I think that in this sense, the age of Berezovsky is still continuing, because this difference between the various sectors of Russian life, between, economy, social life, and politics, is still need a broker. Mm-hmm. Informal broker. I'm not sure.
So this is where the primacy, you still have the primacy of these informal, maybe not primacy, but incredible importance of these informal networks, even when the formal institutions become
and
more important.
The problem of Putin, that he tries to be at the same time broker and krisha, mm-hmm. in one phase.
Yeah.
And that is his great mistake, because it couldn't be so, because Broca is a different role from, a role of, силовики, Крыша, and so on. Крыша couldn't be Broca, because it's Roof, it's Крыша.
That's right. Well, I wanna get to this before, at the end of this segment. I do want to talk about how much Berezovsky's legacy is still with us. Before we get to that, I want to touch on something that I know Mark will have something to say, and I think, Kirill, you will as well, because we were talking about it yesterday off mic. The role of the Siloviki in both of these systems, because they did have a role. It wasn't like the Siloviki didn't exist in the 90s. They were around. But their role in the system was very different. And, Mark, I wanted you to kind of explicate on that a little bit.
Yeah, again, I think it shows the way that the world has changed, is that in the 1990s, the Siloviki clearly had power. They had connections, they had information, they had all kinds of resources. But nonetheless, they were scrambling to try and adapt to the new order. And they were scrambling to, in effect, monetize the resources that they had. They were violent entrepreneurs. They were turning their ability to use coercion into something that could get them money. And Berezovsky was very much, I think, a beneficiary of that. Because, again, going back to this point about Berezovsky's role as often being a broker, a connector, a mediator, and a middleman, he was able to allow these Siloviki to do very well for themselves. So in that respect, they were still, to a degree, dependent on him. However, if we look at the way the wheel has turned, now actually the Siloviki have very well established their ability to convert office into assets, resources, and just downright cash. So that I think what's happened now is, in a way, they don't need a Berezovsky. They need people for all kind of things, and here Kirill's spot on about the issue of still needing a broker and so forth, and I agree with you when you're saying that informal ties still matter, even in terms of mediating within the formal institution. But the point is, whereas in the 1990s they were to a degree dependent upon Berezovsky, now I think in some ways, if we look at Berezovsky's heirs, the economic oligarchs, insofar as we can still call them oligarchs, quite frankly, they are much more dependent upon the Siloviki. I think in that respect, the power structure has turned. The Siloviki have learnt the lessons of the 1990s. Most of them are now businessmen who happen to have uniforms on, whereas in the 1990s, it was the other way round. Mm-hmm. They were essentially state security officials who were trying to work out how you do business.
Also, one of the key differences I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that in the 90s, the Siloviki were, you couldn't speak of the Siloviki. They were very fragmented. Every oligarch had their own little band of Siloviki, and they were basically used by the oligarchs. I mean, it was a mutually dependent relationship. They were using each other, but the oligarchs were definitely in charge. The worm has turned in the sense that now the Siloviki are more united than they were in the 90s. I still don't want to say they're a monolithic block, because you would slap me down for that in a second. But they're much more united than they were in the 90s. But they were certainly, you would say they were more fragmented then, and more kind of dependent, not just on Berezovsky, but on all of the oligarchs, on Patanin, on Hodorkovsky, on Gusinski, on all of the oligarchs. They were set against each other in a lot of ways.
They were, shall we say, kind of politically fragmented, even while being morally united, in the sense of actually the Siloviki shared considerable convictions about what they felt about the new Russia, what they felt about the collapse of the Soviet Union, etc. But precisely because at that point they were still the dependents, the supplicants, who needed the oligarchs. In practical terms, yes, they became fragmented, and so each oligarch hired his own entourage of thugs and buggers, in the entirely electronic eavesdropping sense of the word. And therefore, in practical terms, they did become completely sort of fragmented, but they still retained that certain unity of belief. Frankly, they resented, I'm not talking about every single Siloviki or whatever, but in the main, they resented this dependence on the new rich business types, of whom Berezovsky was obviously the archetype. And that, I think, also explains one reason why, when the wheel turned under Putin, it turned so quickly. Because he was able to draw on that resentment and more or less say, look, you've worked for these guys long enough, now it's time we show them who's really boss. And that was a very appealing thing for them.
Well, one almost gets the sense that when Berezovsky handpicked Putin, and when that was clear that Putin was headed for the big chair, it's almost like they collectively said, aha, now's our chance. You know, do you get the sense, because this did happen so rapidly after Putin came to power, do you get the sense that, I don't want to say they all met in some room and hatched some conspiracy or something, I don't have my tinfoil hat on today, but you almost get the sense that they did sense, aha, this is our chance. All right, now's our chance. Let's get them. Do you see that?
I love the image of all these Siloviki high-fiving each other in some back room. I don't think so, but I think actually that reflects, again, the way of Putin's rise. I mean, even though, you know, he was ex-KGB, even though he'd been head of the Federal Security Service and so forth, and, you know, people knew that, as it were, he was on their side generally. But I think even within the Siloviki community, they didn't really know exactly what they were getting. Yes, they were happy with Putin in terms of he was the best option available to them. But precisely because Putin's rise had been marked by this phenomenally chameleon-like ability to seem all things to all people, you know, and I think there was some optimism, there was some hope, but there wasn't quite that sense of, good Lord, you know, this is really going to be our moment. Until actually Putin was in office and suddenly started. I mean, I think it was more that just suddenly when you have things like, you know, the way that the Chechen war was fought, the way Berezovsky was exactly, you know, various signals, that's when they suddenly realized he really is on our side. He really is one of us.
And you're bang on about the chameleon-like properties of Putin. I mean, I was working as a correspondent in the 90s, Putin being a local politician. A lot of people thought he was on their side. A lot of liberals thought he was on their side in Petersburg because he was a Sobchak man. In fact, I remember writing a piece when Putin was named head of the FSB, citing some of the top human rights defenders in Petersburg, saying, you know, this is good. Finally, we got the best variant of somebody to lead the FSB because Putin's, you know, more or less liberally inclined. I think if they all saw this piece now, it's still on the web, they would have heart attacks collectively. But this was the case. Putin was kind of a chameleon in a blank slate to a lot of people. Kirill, anything you want to add about the role of the Siloviki in both systems?
Just to continue this idea that in 1990, Siloviki was, they were, you know, a sort of tool, yeah? And they played a role of a tool, of instrument. And the instrument uprised in 2000, and now they think about themselves as not as of, you know, tools, but as those who have a power, real power. But it's very interesting from the psychological or social psychological point of view. There are two different, you know, stages of Russian history, 1990s and 2000s until now. In 1990s, the main description of state of mind of oligarchs and all these people around Yeltsin and so on was paranoia. They were obsessed with money and power. And that was...
They knew it could slip away at any moment.
Yes, and that was absolutely paranoid. And from the rise of Putin, schizophrenia beat paranoia. Because all these Siloviki, all these former KGB, whatever, agents and generals and so on, at the same time, they are very nostalgic about Soviet times. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they gained almost everything in Russia from the changes.
Right.
That is a real schizophrenia. Absolutely. And in some sense...
Or it's hypocrisy.
Yeah. No. Schizophrenia. They really believe...
Both things
simultaneously. Yes, at the same time. Yeah. It's a clear clinic picture. And in some sense, we can describe these two periods of Russian history as from paranoia to schizophrenia. And what will be the next period?
I don't know, but I'm sure we'll do a podcast about it. Before we move on to the next section, there's something I posted a blog today called Berezovsky Lives, an intentionally provocative headline, where I basically argue that the system Berezovsky lorded over in the 90s is still very much with us today. As I said at the outset, the importance of informal networks, the continued role of intrigue, in so on. Mark, we've touched on this a bit here and there, but I mean, is that a stretch, or did Putin simply perfect fine-tune and centralize what Berezovsky once lorded over? Or did he create something entirely new? Not entirely new, but new.
Honestly, I think it is quite new. I think, again, we can see many of the same characteristics about sort of, you know, the informal court politics and so forth of the 1990s, which, let's face it, were not just brand new creations of the 1990s. One can see them also in Soviet politics.
And pre-Soviet politics.
Well, precisely. there are some grand traditions that part of the Russian idea almost. But I think what has changed is precisely the role of the state. And I think that's more than just a minor issue or a question of quite where the forum is. State institutions do matter. And I think in this respect, we're seeing a constant struggle between, very broadly speaking, two sort of wings of the Russian elite, the exploiters and the builders. Now, neither of them are good guys or bad guys. I mean, on the whole, unfortunately, many of them are bad guys. if we look at Putin 1.0, however much one can sort of decry his goals and his methods, he was a builder. He did take a country that really was in an awful situation and, you know, reinstitute powers of the state and just generally bring considerable degrees of stability to it. And I think that has changed the political environment. So you're still seeing this struggle, and Berezovsky is a kind of the archetype of the uber exploiter. So we're still seeing this struggle, but we're seeing it, I think, in a rather different institutional, social, and political context, and that really does matter.
Mm. Kirill?
I think in some sense Putin is a real heir of Berezovsky, and today's regime is a real heir of Berezovsky attitude to politics. We already discussed several times that there is no any ideology in modern Russian politics, and we have a very low pragmatism instead of ideology. And the father of this new pragmatism in Russian politics is Berezovsky.
Cynicism, I would call it. Pragmatism is
so
being charitable.
I'm a little bit cautious. pragmatism. I'm not a moralist. I'm not Leo Tolstoy, and so on. We're trying to analyze, not to
oh no, but there is a difference between pragmatism and cynicism.
Yes. Anyway, he was a father of Russian political pragmatism, a real father. And in this sense, Putin is his devoted son. And moreover, if we'll see, if we look at, all this period of Putin's rule, he terribly needed all the time a kind of, this type of broker, as Berezovsky. In some sense, Surkov was such figure. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting that this play or try, this attempt to connect various powers or groups of population and so on. The difference was that if Berezovsky tried to play with various oligarchs, Surkov tried to play with various social groups, mm-hmm. with their interests. And that was, in some sense, that was a very humble root of a new politics. Of course, very sinister. Of course, very, cynical. Okay. But he played with, some social interests, mm-hmm. and cultural interests, but not with the, private interests of, Abramovich and so on. Mm-hmm. And after he resigned and after the new, line of presidential administration was introduced, this time of Berezovsky returned, because now Volodin and all these people, they try to play between various figures, mm-hmm. not social. They are not interested in the interests, social groups and classes and so on. They are still playing at the same field, on the same field as Berezovsky played. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, we still live in Berezovsky political legacy.
And on that note, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of Boris Berezovsky's legacy and look more closely at his long and turbulent relationship with Vladimir Putin. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in the studio in Prague is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian Service. And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Putin's Russia is very dangerous.
Борис Березовский — это кто?
They say you can learn a lot about a person from the friends and allies they keep. But you can also learn a lot from the enemies and adversaries they fight. Boris Berezovsky and Vladimir Putin have been both friends and allies and enemies and adversaries. Kirill, what can we glean from the relationship, and it is a complex relationship, between these two men who in turn dominated Russian politics for the two decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union?
As we said several minutes before, first of all, there are two people with various backgrounds and from belongs to various generations. Berezovsky's background is academic background, Soviet academic background. It's very important Soviet academic background. But he was not a real scientist. Of course, he defended his theses and so on, and I have some information about how he did it. But I'll be mute. He was a very good... I know several opinions and heard several opinions about his activity in academy and previously in scientific institutions. He was a very good manager. But he was a very good manager in a very distilled water of late Soviet academy. And that is very important. In this context, wit, cleverness, and ability to intrigue, are most important things. Let's see at Putin. His background is, murky and very, gray.
Slums of Leningrad.
Yes.
KGB.
Yes, and so on. And he, in some sense, of course, he's much more, simple than Berezovsky. And this comparison is very interesting. In some sense, Russian politics and even Russian life in 1990s was more sophisticated than under Putin's rule, and political system, and maybe social system, and
was subtler.
So on. Yes, and that's why a lot of Russian people look back at 1990s as a time of chaos. In their mind, chaos means be sophisticated, be complex. And it's very interesting. They are the heroes of different, parts or different periods of Russian history, of sophisticated and, of course, chaotic one of 1990s, and a much more simple and straightforward of 2000s.
But yet they were allies, and yet they had a relationship during the... Their relationship didn't begin when Berezovsky plucked...
Sorry for interrupting you. Their relationships were a part of this complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting because this sophisticated political life in 1990s in Russia could, include anything with any people with various backgrounds. And they mixed them, but that was not a kind of, kind of bouillon. Right. That was a kind of akroshka.
Mark, this relationship didn't start in 1999. Berezovsky and Putin knew each other through the 90s. Putin, according to legend, showed up at Berezovsky's birthday party at one point unexpectedly. What can you tell us about this relationship, and what does this relationship tell us about where Russia's been and where it may be headed?
In many ways, I'm not sure if we should be thinking of Putin as having been Berezovsky's ally or just simply having been a candidate in an extensive multi-stage job interview. I think it seems clear that from a very early stage, and yes, they interacted on all kinds of levels from St. Petersburg onwards, that Putin was, I'm not sure if quite the word cultivating is quite the right word, but probably would work, actually, that he saw Berezovsky as someone who was important and needed to basically be brought on board. So really what we actually have is two people who are both playing the game of really trying to manipulate and use the other. The thing is that, Berezovsky, and it's difficult with Berezovsky because this is part of sort of what are generally regarded as his charm, is the fact that he is this ebullient fantasist who also just happens to be very clever and very successful in his time. But I don't think ultimately he was very good at understanding that other people play games too. And that other people might actually be clever and so forth in their own way. So, you know, whether we're talking about his court battle with Abramovich through to his sort of relationship with Putin, actually the interesting story is how often Berezovsky has outsmarted himself. Whereas I'm sure Putin had no illusions about where Berezovsky felt that he fitted and what he wanted from him. So, I mean, if we're thinking back and using the sort of the metaphor of Putin as the spy, after all, you know, part of his job in the KGB was to cultivate assets, which is often a long-term process in which you identify what the other person wants, what are the buttons that you need to push, and carefully prepare yourself to actually be able to push them and recruit them. That, for me, is the relationship, is actually that Putin was recruiting Berezovsky, even while Berezovsky thought he was recruiting Putin.
So in a sense, the relationship between these two men is a microcosm of the relationship between the oligarchs and the Siloviki writ large that we talked about in the first segment, yeah?
Absolutely. And yeah. That's a good way of thinking of it.
Kirill, anything
you want to some extent, of course, because Berezovsky, he wasn't, a regular oligarch.
Right, he was the uber oligarch.
Yes, yes, and Putin wasn't a regular Silovik, because a regular Silovik could be, a general of KGB general or something like this. He was not such a strong and powerful figure. In some sense, he's a part of a very late Soviet legacy.
Mm-hmm.
But real Siloviki in 1990s was they were very powerful in their field in 1980s, and that is the difference. This is the next generation mm-hmm. of Siloviki. That's why I think these relationships were very complicated and in some sense fruitful.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the relationship after Berezovsky went into exile? Because at that point they also had a relationship of sorts. Berezovsky was the perfect foil for Putin. If Putin didn't have Berezovsky, he would have had to invent him. Berezovsky was the symbol of the wild and crazy 90s, that the corrupt oligarchic period that Putin, according to his own legend, vanquished, but didn't really. What's Putin going to do without Berezovsky now?
Poor Putin.
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. I think Putin will survive. I mean, I think it's perfectly true that Berezovsky was phenomenally useful to Putin. And it's the interesting thing about how he didn't really seem to learn. I mean, he'd been pushed out of Russia because he made the mistake of bringing knife-like wit to a gunfight and not realizing that ultimately, he was outmatched in that respect. But once he was in exile, he talked the talk of wanting to bring down Putin, and that particular soundbite that you played at the head of the podcast, really exemplified that, implying that he was, happy to see violence being used to bring down this unconstitutional figure, because we obviously know how dear the Constitution was to Berezovsky. He was actually strikingly inactive and unsuccessful in what he did. He had his little court. He obviously sort of supported figures like Litvinenko. He clearly had some kind of connection with the Chechen exile government. But in practice, he was monstrously supine. I mean, he huffed and he puffed, but he did very, very little that could in any way meaningfully impact Putin. If compare, for example, what he did to what Bill Browder has done. Two rich people with an axe to grind, one of whom has been phenomenally assiduous, he's been willing to spend time and money and lobbying for something meaningful, and has brought about the Magnitsky Law, which may well then sort of as a domino effect, cause all sorts of other countries to bring about laws affecting the criminal sort of figures within the Russian government. Berezovsky, on the other hand, huffed and puffed, and in the process gave Putin a perfect enemy figure and did absolutely nothing to in any way meaningfully undermine Putin at home.
Mm. Kirill?
I think he was very unsuccessful in all his political activity, I agree with Mark, in 2000 until his death. And it's very interesting that in post-Soviet context, he was like, you know, he tried to play Machiavelli or Cardinal Mazarini in one phase, but that was very unsuccessful. He failed. He was not really Machiavelli because he could not understand people. He couldn't understand people. That was his first weak point. And his second point, he didn't know the country called Russia. Absolutely. Absolutely. He never heard that he traveled, you know, outside Moscow or St. Petersburg. He never met not just ordinary people, but, you know, ordinary KGB general in some, you know, Yekaterinburg or something like this. And he thought that everything could be, you know, gained in Alexandre Dumas' Three Musketeers style. Yes, mm-hmm. Just several people who try to trick each other and someone will win. And he thought that he will win because he is, you know, he's an academic, he is a mathematician, he is very witty, he, you know, very rich and so on. No, such game is, you know, doomed. Is absolutely doomed in Russia. And I think that if you speak about future and what can what could Putin do without Berezovsky today, I think he terribly need two Berezovskys at the same time. One for internal affairs and one for foreign affairs. And the reason is very simple. Because he made, or his team made, a sort of, you know, fake or whatever. We told a lot of times about this, a fake state. This state couldn't deal with serious problems. And if they couldn't, if they cannot do this, you know, today, with really serious problems officially in the limitations, inside the limitations of state politics. Of course, he need Berezovsky, symbolic Berezovsky, as a broker, as a, you know, informal...
So he needs the Berezovsky of the 90s.
Yes, he need the Berezovsky of the 90s in internal politics, and at the same time, having in mind all this today's trouble with Germany, with United States, and so on, he needs you know, kind of international Berezovsky at the same time. So that is very interesting. That is, I think, that is a total failure of Putin's politics because he didn't or he haven't achieved any of his aims. Instead of being super power and super rich. And that's all. Mm. And that is not an idea of a real statesman.
Well, that leads us to the question I want to wrap up with. This man was, I mean, in a lot of ways, he's a seminal figure in Russian history. I mean, but can there ever be another Berezovsky? Mark.
Can there ever be another Berezovsky? Well, not a Berezovsky as such, because precisely I don't think that Berezovsky created anything. He was a product, he was a creature, he was the apotheosis of the 90s in all their chaotic, rapacious, money-grubbing, backdoor politicking glory. And as such, unless Russia slides back into that, you're not going to get another Berezovsky, at least not in the same scale. But on the other hand, precisely, I think the thing is that Berezovsky should be seen as a symbol of its time. There are going to be other symbols. It'll be interesting to see who the symbol of this particular decade turns out to be. So there are often going to be these figures, but it's certainly not going to be a Berezovsky figure.
Kirill, last word to you.
Yeah, two Berezovskys. Of course, I'm not speaking about real Berezovsky instead of real Berezovsky.
We understood.
I'm speaking, the Berezovsky clones.
You're not into cloning, are you?
Cloning, yes. But I think Putin needs two Berezovsky as a role model. Someone like Kudrin for foreigners. And someone like, you know, maybe Prokhorov for domestic oligarchs and so on. Of course, there are different figures and with different backgrounds and so on. But in some sense, I agree with
Mark. So you're saying he needs a better manager.
Yes. In some sense, they're both of them, Prokhorov and Kudrin, they're, you know, the products of 2000s. Mm-hmm. And that is very important. And that could be, you know... a new stage of Russian politics, maybe in some sense, because he couldn't cope with all these problems, and we see it clearly just now.
So he's missing the talent that Berezovsky brought to the table.
Yes,
it's an interesting way to...
Yes, he lost this ability in for these 13 years.
That's all we have time for today, unfortunately. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russian security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
I would also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.